Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
For a lot of parents, getting your little one to eat variety isn't always the easiest of tasks. But with Yo Valley's new little Yo yogurt pouches, you no longer have to worry. Made from British organic whole milk and organic fruit purees, you can relax knowing that you will be supported in reaching their important milestones. With live cultures, the Little Yo pouches are perfect for supporting and nurturing healthy, happy tummies, ideal for weaning and allows your babies to explore new flavours from as young as 6 months. Available in those two delicious flavours, which come in recyclable pouches, these Little Yo yogurts are perfect for snacking and on the go. To find out more, head to yovalley.co.uk and find it in your local supermarkets. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to this week's Food for Thought, a podcast that's on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice that you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhianna Lambert, registered nutritionist, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authoritative voices in health, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest and happiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. Many of us don't stop to consider how much we're drinking, and in lots of cases, it can be more than we realise. It can often be that trip to the doctor that forces you to really think about how much you are consuming week on week. For some, this might just be the realisation that you're actually drinking in excess, with a reliance on alcohol that you didn't even know really existed. This week's Food for Thought sees myself and mental health nurse Mark Holmes, who specialises in substance misuse, delve into alcohol and addiction to explore how it can change us and what we can do to prevent this from happening. Hello, Mark.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. We are recording this, it feels like the crack of dawn to me, to be honest, Mark, but the conversation we're about to have probably is something people would associate, you think, stereotypically with the evening habits, but actually for some it could be all day long. So we know that the health implications of drinking alcohol are pretty strong. Would it be better for us all on a whole if we were just teetotal?
No, that's a good question. I mean, if we look at it, if alcohol, yeah, we know that alcohol is highly carcinogenic. We know there's a link there between alcohol and cancer. We know that it's linked to 60 different medical conditions. There's always that balance as well about being human and looking for new experiences, and we're social creatures, and for some people alcohol plays a really important part in that. So in a way alcohol, I could just talk for my own personal life, is that I wouldn't have met my wife. We probably wouldn't have had my three children without the aid of alcohol. Our relationship with alcohol as humans is very much complex. We think we've been probably doing it from state of evolution. So to actually say we're going to get rid of this substance, then that's not going to happen. And it's also been aware of that people often say, oh, we should ban it. You know, if alcohol was a new substance that was coming out, we'd ban it. That's probably true, but actually but it hasn't. We've grown up around it. You know, the way that we process alcohol, the way we've evolved, is because we're living side by side with it, throughout our evolutionary cycle.
That's such a wonderfully put, balanced point of view, which is very, very true. I think it's so ingrained in us as human beings. It's such an interesting way of looking at it. So let's talk about what alcohol actually is. Let's kick off by saying, you know, what's going on inside our bodies when we drink alcohol?
Yeah, so it's there's a few things to perspectives to look for, from it. So one is the taking of it. Most people drink it, of course. There was a fashion, if you remember rightly, in the well, I'm a bit older than you, but where people pouring shots in their eyes and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I missed that one.
yeah. There's all kinds of weird stuff going off on holidays in Ibiza. But anyway, I'll tell you about that another time. But we drink it, and it goes obviously into the mouth, and then goes down your esophagus, into your stomach, and then a few sphincters, and into your duodenum, and ends up basically in the liver. So you've got this kind of without sounding kind of too negative all the time here, but you have got this toxic substance. That, yeah, as we described before, you know, it's people's choice if they want to drink it or not, going through the system. So you've got health pinch points that all of those as it's going in. And then it hits the liver. I've ran liver clinics for a number of years, and this is where most people associate actually alcohol-related health harms with the liver. We've really got to look broader than that, but we'll look at the liver just a second. And that you've got a chemical called alcohol dehydrogenase in your liver, and that helps synthesize the alcohol into another chemical called acetaldehyde. Now, this acetaldehyde is the byproduct of the body getting rid of the alcohol. This fat produced, and that's what people can get a condition called fatty liver. But there's also this byproduct. Now, the unfortunate thing for the human body is this acetaldehyde is also highly carcinogenic. So not only are you putting a carcinogen in your body, you're also as you're getting rid of it, you're also producing a carcinogen in as a consequence as well. So the body gets synthesized and gets rid of it that way. Then you've got the effects actually on the brain, of course, which is the so you've got so this is that there's kind of that kind of the functional sort of bit about how the alcohol gets rid of. So you've got that going now. When you drink alcohol, if you can think of your brain being a bit like a seesaw, this is not my analogy. This is written about 50 years ago, actually. And I always get the person's name right. It's Heimelbach or something like they had used the seesaw analogy. But this seesaw analogy has been kind of well proven, and it's been well used. And that is that. So you're drinking your alcohol, and that actually stimulates a chemical GABA in the brain that calms. That calms your brain down. So this is why for most people when they drink alcohol, they feel that sense of, you know, calmness, relaxation. As people say, that one of the difficulties of alcohol is we know it's a depressant on the central nervous system, but we're talking about the word stimulant here as well. So, but it's definitely a depressant, but it does stimulate this chemical GABA, and that in turn calms that brain down. Then after about the third or fourth drink, you start blocking a chemical called glutamate. More glutamate means more anxiety. Less glutamate means less anxiety. So remember, this is blocking it. And therefore, you know, you're feeling incredibly relaxed. And this is why when people go from this a bit relaxed when they're kind of in after a few glasses, after a few drinks, should we say, to when you've had quite a bit, you feel really a lot less anxious when you've been drinking alcohol. Now what of course happens here is that if this seesaw analogy kicks in, and this seesaw analogy, you can also think of it as in, do you know when you kind of have a sugary drink, so the sugar drink, you get the sugar rush, but actually unfortunately because you've had the sugar rush, the body's producing chemicals to deal with that sugar, and it overshoots the mark. So the same thing, and therefore you end up with a potential, a few hours later, you get this dip in your blood sugar because you've had this increase in your by taking the sugary drink. So on the brain, because your alcohol has been stimulating GABA, blocking the glutamate, your brain, in the seesaw analogy, says, actually, I've got to do something to restore the seesaw back to its normal state. So it's trying to balance that seesaw out. So it does that by counterbalancing the GABA and the glutamate levels. Now, that's the danger. This is where the danger we get here about how alcohol affects your brain, because the seesaw goes the other way. the next day, this is where some people get the increase in anxiety, the increase in those kind of, my daughter calls it hangxiety or beer fear. Because what's happened is the seesaw, the body's had to say, hang on, you've been putting this alcohol in the system, it's causing the imbalance on this side, I'm producing a chemical on the other side. And this is why people wake up with this added anxiety. So it does. There's no doubt this is affecting people's brain, and the brain learns to do this and it adapts. So it does it faster. So and this is what you get. This is how you get tolerance to alcohol. Your brain adapts. So this is why. Again, using myself as an example, I remember being a catering student before I became a nurse at Clarendon College in Nottingham, and I remember having a few pints. I had about 3 pints of beer when I was about 17. I shouldn't have been doing that, of course. That's naughty. And fell off the bar stool drunk. But by the time I left Huddersfield Poly, I could be drinking 190 to 210 units of alcohol a week. So that would kill me now. But what's interesting is that it's how your brain learns to adapt. It adapts to the situation. So most of you out there, you yourself, if you drink alcohol, that you're aware that your brain has adapted to cope with alcohol in this way. You know, we learn behaviorally how to deal with the alcohol, but we also, your brain learns physically how to do it. And that process can be slightly unlearned as well. And this is where you have a drop in tolerance. So that's a whistle stop tour, sorry.
That was so comprehensive, and it actually took me right back, unfortunately, to my university days, Mark, with all the explanation, especially with the glutamine and the different bits. I think one thing that a lot of people will be listening to is they're like, right, so that's how it works. But some people may think, oh, but it affects me differently to my friend. You know, so despite the science there, does alcohol really affect us uniquely as well?
I really do believe it. I mean, I've done over three. I mean, I'm a nurse by background, mental health nurse, and I've done over 3,000, well over 3,000 assessments of people with alcohol problems. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and it is a very much individual experience, and that's kind of one of the problems we've got with alcohol treatment and alcohol. Have I got an alcohol problem? That question, or am I an addict? Is that because it's very much individual, and it will depend on perhaps your kind of what's happened to you socially, your social circles. A bit like so you rightly said there, haven't you, about the when you're at university, you've got all that peer pressure going on, haven't you? You've got all those social factors, but you've also got those kind of personal biological factors there potentially as well. And also you've potentially got, and I really strongly advocate for this, as in when I do an assessment with someone who's been developing alcohol problems, there's often a mental health issue there as well. It's so common that, you know, it may be a bit of like social anxiety, it may be past trauma, there's normally a background, and alcohol is actually being used as some kind of coping mechanism. So this is the thing about being individual here. I really do believe it's very much in an individual way. You've got different theories as well, of course, about how that affects it. So some people think that is it affecting me different from a friend? You will have some people screaming at this podcast right now. They're just saying it's a disease. It's a disease of the brain, or it's purely about these sort of the brain chemicals, the chemicals in your brain. I've already described some brain chemistry there, but actually that doesn't actually describe potentially addiction in its full, but that can pull that drive to take a substance. You've got other people who are behavioralists, like Jeffrey Shaler, who will actually say addiction is a choice. People choose to be addicted to things. It's actually a choice. So now again, I subscribe to a bit of all of that, really. I think when you're doing an assessment and you're asking about what is a problem, does it affect me differently in each way? It does affect you differently in each way, but that depends on a variety of those kind of social, personal, biological factors. Where you're living, your diet as well. It all encompasses it. We know that alcohol affects people in poorer communities than it does in the kind of middle class communities. So for me, there's a definite bit about individuality. I suppose to answer your question about, how do I know I'm beginning to get a problem? That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Because when I'm seeing people, I was based at the Queen's Medical Centre in Nottingham for a number of years, and you would often think, oh, if only I could got in there a little bit early. We still do things with people who are really developed a larger problem, but if we could nip it in the bud. And some of that is about, having that question with yourself. How do I know that I'm developing that kind of problem? And we've got some really kind of useful tools for that. One of them is called the Alcohol Use Disorders Identification Tool. It's just 10 questions. And a lot of you out there would have seen that anyway, actually. They've probably all been asked questions from it. So when you start reading it, if you went on to... there's lots of websites out there. So, like, if you go to a website like Drink Coach on there, the Drink Coach will show you, will go through that audit questionnaire. It's based on the World Health Organization. And then what we're, the question about where, am I developing a problem? It will, there's kind of five areas that we look for. So, one is that compulsion to drink. Have you got the strong desire? Or sometimes I say overwhelming desire to take alcohol. Then we were talking about tolerance. So another area is about tolerance. Do I need to get an increased dose to get the same effect? So am I developing a tolerance to this? Another one is around control. Are you having difficulties controlling your alcohol behavior? Once you start drinking, you find it hard to stop drinking. The other bit is about withdrawal. And you know that seesaw analogy? If you push that seesaw analogy further, the more that you drink, the more the brain adapts, the more that balance becomes a bit more aggressive. And this is why people can get in a real bad state with alcohol withdrawal. And remember, alcohol withdrawal can kill people. So it's a life-threatening problem, alcohol withdrawal. So we always have to be careful about withdrawal when we give advice about that. And then the other thing is about salience. So again, I'd be checking in with myself. And am I over prioritizing alcohol over other interests? They're not quite as clear cut, of course, as sometimes people think. They're like tolerance, at what point does the tolerance becoming a problem? And again, probably you find, say we're talking about university, that you probably started off with a glass or two of wine or beer, and then you can net quite a lot more, couldn't you, by the end of university life? So it's complex, very individual. That's a long answer to that very simple question.
But it's interesting.
But this is the fascinating thing about the whole area of addiction and dependence is. It is fascinating, and every day is a school day. I used to go in 20 years ago. I would have told you that this is all behaviour. It's behaviour, but actually, I've seen 19-year-old people die of liver cirrhosis. And it typically takes 8 to 10 years to develop that liver cirrhosis. And I've seen so much, and you question all the time. Actually, is it that simple? And the answer is, it's not that simple.
Gosh, that's so sad. That really struck me when you said that, actually. And I think it is important to remember that this does take lives. And it's serious, but equally, like you said, it does affect people. That blew my mind. And about the fact that our brain adapts over time, it's almost like the human body, it always blows my mind, to be honest, how fascinating it is. And then there's also comments that people will make. I'm just trying to think of questions when we were writing this brief that our listeners would want to know from you, Mark, with all your experience.
Yeah.
Also, what type of alcohol? Because I think a lot of people think if they have a certain spirit, it has more of an effect than perhaps having a glass of wine. Is that true, that different types can affect us in a different way as well?
Yeah, so this is again another really interesting area. So... Right, remind me to go through two things. There's the physical bit and the psychological bit. So
yeah.
there's really interest. So there's a you've got the absorption of alcohol for a start. So not all alcohol is absorbed in this, or ethanol, the molecule ethanol, that's what we should be talking about, is ethanol. So, but of course, when we're talking about alcohol, we tend to talk about it in different kind of drinks, different forms, as you say. So we could be talking about different strengths. So if we stick to the same strength alcohol here, it's the ethanol or the alcohol in it that's causing the effect. Now you can get higher alcohols and methanols in there, so it's knocking around as well. But we'll stick to the ethanol. So ethanol is the ethanol that's causing the intoxication in this case. So if you've got a full stomach, for instance, when you take that drink, if it's the same amount of ethanol in a glass, we've got a large glass of wine at about 12%, and then we've got a pint of premium lager, or a triple scotch. Yeah, so that, yeah, triple vodka. So they're all the same kind of units. Now, if you drink on an empty stomach, the absorption you'll get a higher peak ethanol level. So you tend to get a higher peak ethanol level. So the more of the alcohol is going in faster, all the alcohol is going to go in eventually. But actually, if you've got a full stomach, that alcohol dehydration is in your liver is also in your stomach as well. So you get some absorption and breakdown of the alcohol before it goes in properly. But also with the alcohol, if you're drinking on an empty stomach, the alcohol can produce hydrochloric acid and some kind of other stuff to mix it together, because typically your body likes to absorb alcohol about 18 to 22% alcohol by volume. So actually, if you're drinking tequila shots, etc., and you're mixing it with a kind of soda, sort of carbon dioxide based drink, it will go in faster than it would do if you're drinking a straight tequila, the same amount of units. I mean, it typically goes in faster than that. So there's an absorption bit there as well. Physically, it would depend. This is why we encourage people to eat before they go out on, if they're going to go out on a binge, to eat. So you're going to hold that alcohol up, hopefully not going to get this rise in this blood ethanol level. Because of course, the higher the blood ethanol levels, the more intoxication you may feel, and then that loss of self control you may feel as well. And when we're talking to people on Drink Coach about kind of interventions, I'll often find at what point in their drinking behavior do they feel like they're losing control of the drinking, which is now some people say very quickly, but other people will say typically on drinking, people start losing that control after about half a bottle of wine, that they feel like they're it's really hard then to say no to the next bit. So they set out the good intentions and do that. So this blood ethanol level is really, really important though, because what we're trying to keep it down for, so you feel less intoxicated. So you've got some physical stuff going on there with that alcohol, but you've got some psychological stuff going on as well. And these are called expectancies. And this is where psychology has its play. And this is why, the advertising of alcohol is so heavily regulated, because people are given nudges in one way, in an advertising way. So you're not meant to associate alcohol with, fun and all this kind of stuff because of the association. But we all have expectancies of what different drinks would do to us. And there's lots of research on this, and that can actually affect the way that you. That you feel the sensation of alcohol. So I'll give you an example. Back in the day, you probably, because you're a lot younger than me, gin used to be called Mother's Ruin. Because right back to the Hogarth, Gin Lane type of thing, that idea that gin was a bad drink. But actually now gin's quite, I think it's probably shook off that image. But if you go back 20 years ago, if I'd said what drink makes you miserable when you drink, they'd say gin. Mm-hmm. Now that goes right back to Hogarth. That goes right back there. Wow. And it also may be about how you've also not just about how our society has done it, but it may be that's how you associate it with your own mood as well. So there are expectancies on different drinks. There's other beers that have got nicknames have they got expectancies attached to them or slang words for them? I won't go into that, but when they've got slang words attached to them, and that is probably to do with more about the levels of alcohol in that drink, you know, 3 units a pint rather than perhaps two and a bit units a pint. So there is this kind of there is this association between psychological association between what drinks do and how it makes them feel. So we can't discount, oh, it's just psychological, because they're there. They're real for the person. So it's alcohol's a complex thing. I remember getting my mum and dad drunk. One of my first things around alcohol was a really fascinating one. Then my mum and dad had again, this is expected about what alcohol does to you. My mum and dad were, they won't mind me saying this, but they had a dinner party around, and I was getting a bit miffed about them. I didn't want them to, being a health-conscious 14-year-old, I was quite conscious of them about drinking too much. But, you know, they don't drink that much, but when they had some friends around. So I did, I remember it was my job, it's just back in the day, gone 50, pour out the drinks for them, which is quite odd. So odd, probably saying that now, isn't it? It's half the charges. But what I did was that rather than get them worse for wear, I was worried about the health. What I used to do was I used to dip my finger in the whiskey and pour it around the edge of the glass, and then pour the tonic in or the mixer in. And I did this for Jim. And I used to get, what I was fascinated with, I did it once and I used to do it all the time. Yeah, God, this is probably the first time I've heard about this. I used to watch them getting more and more intoxicated throughout the night, but they weren't drinking. And I thought that was really that was my own little fascinating 14-year-old
experiment. You were doing a study. Yeah, you were doing your own thing.
Doing my own thing. But it's quite interesting about how, and you'll see this potentially. I know that bar staff, I've worked in bars, I know that bar staff sometimes do that as well. So you know, they'll rub alcohol around the edge, either from a sauce or that, back in the day. And then you'll say, I've poured you strong one. And that, because the alcohol is on the outside of the glass, they taste the alcohol. And they go, oof, that's strong. And goes, yeah, put an extra shot in there for you, mate. And actually, there's no alcohol in there at all. They just put it around the edge. Now that was back in the day. It doesn't happen now, of course, but what you do watch, you observe people getting more and more drunk.
Yeah.
And now they're not physically, well, they are probably getting more and more drunk because the alcohol from that's being slowly absorbed in to the system. But there's a lot of psychology going on there. And again, we learn how to psychologically deal with alcohol, don't we, as well? You know, when you had your first drinks, you didn't really know how to react to alcohol, and you actually slowly learn how to try and act not drunk in front of your parents or your carers. You know, you learn that quite fast, don't you? I'm not drunk. And you learn how to mask it. And that happens until you're 50. Definitely.
Do you know, I'm absolutely just in awe of A, how clever you were as a teenager, and then B, the fact that it is so psychological, because our minds are just the most wonderful things. And it does make sense why perhaps some people are more prone to these behaviours than others. It definitely, it's like the whole nature-nurture debate, isn't it, in a way? I guess it's the same with alcohol, isn't it? What makes some people more prone to addiction than others?
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think we also have to be careful about not thinking about them and us as well. Mm. So the danger with some of the terminology we use with addiction, the A word or the D word. So the D word, dependence. I wasn't like when I was a mental health nurse, my consultant psychiatrist I worked with said it was the D word. He didn't like even the word dependence, which got us challenging. I know the reason why he did that, it was to get us to challenge some of the kind of the medical models and that kind of nature nurture, to actually be more inquisitive, you know, about what's going on, finding out what's going on about in people's lives. So we have to be careful with the language, because it's easy to say, well, I haven't got a problem, I'm not an addict, or I'm not an alcoholic, which I'll use the A word. But then some people will identify with the alcoholic word and find it be perfectly fine with it, and it's good for them to use that term. You know, there's lots of benefits for that. So we do have to be careful with the with some of the terminology we use, because we don't want to exclude it. And the people we say on Drink Coach are potentially on the journey exploring their relationship with alcohol. Mm. And I think that's where I like to come from, is that when you see me online and at one of the Drink Coaches, we're trying to explore that relationship, as you say. Whether or not it's medical, psychological, that nature nurture thing, is that I'm trying to think about why are you doing. You know, what the question is what's it all about then? You know, what is your, yeah? I won't say that to them like in that way, but I'm actually thinking, you know, you've done your drink though, you're setting goals, you're still struggling a little bit. What's all this about? What is it really, you know, and trying to, you're inquisitive. You're a bit like a detective, really. Because one of your first question was about, you know, about the, but we've all got this unique relationship with alcohol, haven't we? Yeah. So, yeah. So, the whole thing's fascinating. I've been doing it for nearly, since 1996, I think I've been dealing in this side. And I still find the whole area extremely fascinating, because it's
is it a case of the more you know, the less you know? Do you know what I mean? Like the kind
yes,
of
absolutely,
like
yeah, it. Absolutely, yeah. Some of the questions that come up are things like, so you know, if it's purely a medical thing, a disease of the brain, why are so many people who are over, why are the over 50s now the most more likely to have an alcohol problem than the younger people? So what triggers what? Why all of a sudden does the alcohol problem develop if it's a medical, or if it's purely medical or a disease problem? Why does it develop later in life all of a sudden? Now, it could be. I mean, is it to do with chemicals in the brain deteriorating and that neuroadaptation, or is it more stuff happens to those people? So, you know, I know once we see, you know, when I'm assessing people over 50, often what comes out is they've been recently bereaved, or they've had a bereavement, you know, a bereavement. So you could argue, is it that sense of loss that's driving the alcohol problem? Is it the sense of loss that's been that coping mechanism, or is it the trauma they've seen of that person dying? Because that's another bit.
Yeah, or it's just like there's so much in life, isn't there, that can happen, Mark?
Yes, I mean, yeah.
And the complications, yeah, like you said, that the psychology and what people live through, it's lived experiences that can often dictate how we cope, and it can be a coping strategy. Because alcohol isn't just, we've talked a lot about the social aspect. I'm sure there's elements of peer pressure we haven't mentioned there, or, you know, life. But in general, it also affects the heart, doesn't it? It's linked to cancer. It's linked to strokes, even suicide, psychosis. There's more, isn't there? There's a lot more than people realise.
There is. And I mean, there's an interesting analogy here with alcohol. You know, again, I drink alcohol. I don't mind saying that. You know, I've had a very challenging relationship with alcohol throughout my life. But, which is, for me, you know, always quite interesting in itself.
Yeah.
But I choose to drink in a very much moderate way now. But I am aware, with all the kind of, I suppose, some of the knowledge I've got, is that we know that the kind of the lifetime cancer risk for kind of for me being a man, for in a you know a man and if for those who are female, so if you do it as in, we're about cancer and cigarettes, I suppose, that's what I'm groping in at. So yeah, and the University of Southampton did a study that actually, that if you're drinking a bottle of wine a week, That is the equivalent of, for a woman, 10 cigarettes per week in the, for the cancer risk. And for a man, it's 5 cigarettes per week. So, and we, you know, someone like me who's a non-smoker now, the idea of smoking and the cancer risk would be there. The reason why I wouldn't want to smoke is because of the clear cancer risk. But the alcohol, we don't really talk about that. And certainly with the breast cancer and the cancer risk is there. It really is there as well. So, my family have been, unfortunately, we've got breast cancer very much in our family. Mm. But only 1 in 10 of those cases are actually, generally 1 in 10 of 10 of breast cancer cases are due to your genes. The rest is to do with potentially lifestyle. There's a huge link there with there is a link there between alcohol and breast cancer. So 3 alcoholic drinks per week, 15% chance, higher risk of breast cancer. So we know that there's a link there, and we think, again, do you know when I was talking about how the way that the alcohol gets rid of the acetaldehyde is a byproduct of that alcohol dehydrogenase. There is also effects on your estrogen levels. So again, this is often why we advise all athletes not to drink too much, because it increases this female estrogen level. If you want to build muscle, estrogen actually can have effects on a negative effect on that, but also has a negative effect certainly for women on breast cancer as well. So this is this complexity we've got, and at the same time, for the government side, they've got this kind of complexity of, we know that it causes all this damage, all this harm. Nearly 6,000 people die each year of an alcohol-related problem. And if you, again, put it in that context of the times we're in at the moment, with certain, you know, we're a bit obsessed with death rates and graphs. 6,000 is a lot of people. That's a lot of people. And over half a million people are currently what we call alcohol dependent in this country.
Wow.
Only 16% of them are in treatment.
If you think
about that, some of this is about choice, of course, about getting to treatment. But if I said to you, there's a new physical problem out there, and you know, and the access is 16% at the moment for that treatment, you'd go, well, that's appalling. But actually, that's the case. 84% of people with dependence are not in treatment currently. Alcohol is a complex kind of dynamic between the balancing of economics, and it's a bit like what we're doing with coronavirus. And at the moment, there is this balance between economics, health, and harms. And you've got one side, I'm part of the Alcohol Health Alliance, where they will very much go along that. Actually, we need to do more about making the public aware of alcohol issues, but also getting better treatment. But on the other side, you'll see people that obviously there's a huge government income stream as well.
It's so tough. I find these kind of things very difficult. I think everybody deserves access to help, and it's something obviously we strive for in this country to do, but there's still such huge disparities in, like you said, for various different reasons there. And I remember for me, I've rented a lot in London in my life. I've moved so many times, I've lost count. But I have lived once with an alcoholic, and I actually didn't last very, very long. I had to move out very quickly. And it was very difficult for me to watch somebody spiraling and not being able to help, because unless the person admits themselves, it's a very difficult thing to do. Do you have any advice, before I move on to questions from our listeners, Mark, for anyone out there that feels they've got a problem, or perhaps they're a friend or a family member, a carer? What can they do? What are the first steps?
If some of this resonates, what we're talking about here about, you know, kind of the potential loss of control, the over prioritization, there's lots of help there online. But we've got an app called Drink Coach, which is developed partly with the Department of Health as well, on back in the day, about we've been going about 6 or 7 years doing that, and that will that helps you monitor your drinks in a drink diary way. So you got your drink diaries. It's got some tips on kind of how to manage craving, etc. But for me, the starting point would be to start looking. If you're worried about your worried about your drinking, just document down what you're actually doing, and not just the amounts you're drinking. I'm more interested in, why. Why we don't we teach people not to use the word why, but I'm interested in, you know, what is it about? Why did you have that drink on that Tuesday? You know, did you need the drink on the Tuesday? You know, if you're alone in the house, and you open that bottle of wine up, what was it? What were you trying to achieve by that drinking? And to explore that, starts having to think about exploring that your personal relationship with alcohol. What is it about alcohol? So we're not being a killjoy here. And also set a target as well, and see if you can stick to that target. So once you've had got a baseline, it's really quite interesting when you do drink diaries with people, because actually it's so simple, and actually that a lot of people find it really hard to recall what they drank the week before. And actually, if you don't do it on a daily basis, then people forget. You know, so I would it's clear that sometimes when you're doing clinics, someone will say, I drank 3 out of 7 days last week. And then they'll go, oh, actually, I drank on Saturday, I just remembered. So there's not a deliberate misinformation there. I think it's people forget that recall. So I document down, but also document down why that drink's been taken. But then when you're setting goals, see if you can, are you sticking to the goals that you can set for the week before, so you can plan ahead. And if you're not being able to stick to those goals, then it's worth having to think about what's going on there. And then finally, for those people themselves, I'd do a simple decisional balance sheet, which is what's good about drinking and what's not so good about drinking, and try and think about why are you concerned about your drinking, or why are others concerned about the drinking as well? Because some people are in this kind of state of ambivalence where they're being told by the partner that you ought to stop drinking, and actually they say, well, I've got a problem. Take a step back and actually think about what do you think's happening there. You know, are you over prioritizing the alcohol over other things? You know, have they got a point? Be sensible about this. Have they got a point? Do what we call a decisional balance sheet on there. For those people who are trying to support others, you sometimes get this. It depends what stage they're in with their wanting to get help. So we often, you'll be aware of this, the sort of the Prochesca and Clemente is kind of cycle of change kind of thing. We'll have some people a lot of pre-contemplative. Yeah. You know, they're not in, they don't even see it as a problem. They're not there, not there at all. And then we've got other people that are contemplative, and then, you know, people are preparing change and making change. So we've got people all in that cycle. So it will depend on where that person is in that cycle. Of change. I would always say, though, do your homework. So if you've got someone who's, say, pre-contemplative, just find out where the alcohol services are, in the area. You nudge people in the right, nudge, don't finger point and wag. You slowly nudge people into the kind of, slowly sort of pointing things out. So one of the, I'm a big believer in striking when the iron's hot on this kind of thing. So if there's a glimmer of motivation there, this is where you need to know where all the alcohol is, or your GP surgeries or your online services are. I mean, at the moment, there's loads of online help out there to get support. And there's also really good support for carers out there as well. But for me, I know that's a long answer it will depend on where people are in that cycle of change, but I find that confrontation doesn't work, because you end up I've got three teenagers. I was going to say one's now older than a teenager, but if you start being parental here and saying you must do this, you must do that,
you can
you'll
push
end
them
up
away.
With the arms crossed.
Yeah,
push them away. Yeah. It's not going to work. You're not going to have that conversation.
No, I think pushing people away is something that people are probably scared to do as well. I would say that even we have the same thing with poor relationships with food in the nutrition clinic. It's a very it's sensitive. I think that's the word to use to describe this, is that it's a sensitive issue as well. And like you said, it depends where people are within that stages of change model. If they're even aware of it, are they ready or thinking about making a change? Where are they at? That takes me back there as well. But I do need to move on to some questions from our listeners. I think it's very difficult, of course, to offer bespoke advice, especially on a topic like this, but I've picked out one or two here actually that I think you might be able to answer ethically. So Kimberly has said, is red wine actually good for you? And I thought, that's a classic, you know, that's an important one to ask.
Yeah, so you'd be better off with pomegranate juice or grape juice, to be honest, because it's the ethanol that mitigates all of this good for you. I mean, And where someone pick this, actually, sorry, just give you another long answer, but where someone pick you what's good for you? Yeah, so always saying physically good for you. So, you know, for some people, the occasional glass of red wine, it helps them relax, it helps them socialise. I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, but actually, they would describe that there may be a psychological benefit for that. So that's how some people might describe it. Physically, though, we're really assured now that alcohol is, on the World Health Organization's classification of carcinogenic substances, it that trumps everything. So we don't give out advice about safe drinking anymore. Mm. We talk about low risk levels, because actually no alcohol is without risk.
Lulu has asked, Mark, so this will be the last question I think we've got time for, but she said, I don't drink masses, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, probably a couple of glasses of wine a week, but should I be having less to keep it under 14 units?
Well, the advice is that if you go above that, above that 14 units, then you start getting into that kind of more significant kind of health harms. So the less you drink is better physically. But I'd also look at kind of, look at that relationship about what it is around about the alcohol. It's not, are you drinking all the 14 units on one night? I'm not saying you are, are you consuming it in a binge way? Because the problem with talking about 14 units in that way, most people don't know what 14 units looks like, unfortunately, but as well, that's the other thing. It's best to spread that out the week. So it also depends on how long you spread it out the week. So having days off and spreading it thinly throughout the week with those days off, rather than saving up your 14 units for a Friday or Saturday night binge, or split it up on a Friday or Saturday for a couple of binges. Remember, a binge, anything over 6 units. So you could have 2 binges in there and a few sips of wine on another night. So, it's trying to think about it is how you're doing the drinking and what that relationship with alcohol is when you're doing it. And again, I never want to sound like a killjoy on this, but I do see people develop problems all the way along. And actually, if you're asking the question about should I cut down, perhaps there may be some kind of the motivation that you might be around that cycle of change thinking, perhaps I should be thinking about drinking down, and it'd be interesting to explore the reasons why you think you need to be cutting down as well. So again, sorry, long answer to that, but that's right.
No, that sounds really balanced and fair. And this is a hard bit for us to do, Mark, but we're going to do a fact or fiction round. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, so if you could answer fact or fiction, I know there's a lot of nuance, do the following. Number one, alcohol is linked to weight gain.
Absolutely true.
All alcohol is a depressant.
Alcohol is a depressant on the central nervous system.
There we go. Addiction has increased over the past 10 years.
Depends how, as we said before, depends how we describe addiction.
There we go. The quality of your sleep will be affected by drinking alcohol.
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Your body normally likes about 3 to 7 cycles of rapid eye movement sleep, and alcohol being a depressant sends you straight into the deep sleep. People forget that the rapid eye movement sleep is the lighter sleep. These cycles are light sleep. Alcohol gives you that deeper sleep, which is not so beneficial. This is why you can wake up tired after the night before.
There we go. Time is the only cure for hangovers.
The prevention is the only cure for hangovers. But preventative approach, but if you've got a hangover, time and rest,
next one as well, Mark. Always eat before drinking alcohol.
Yes, as I said before, remember that we're trying to lower down the peak blood ethanol level here. There's also that feeling of being full as well, and also that time for that alcohol dehydrogenase in the stomach to start working on to break down the alcohol.
Mark, I think that was a wonderful fact or fiction, Rob, because it's so informative. And I think instead of me waffling on to end the podcast, because this is your area and I can tell how experienced, passionate, knowledgeable you are on this subject, I think to leave our listeners with a food for thought today, my very quick one would probably be that remember that there's different cultural reasons why people do or don't drink. There's different things going on in your life. You can't judge a book by its cover. You never know what is going on behind the scenes. And that's something that impacts everybody. And you don't know what childhood someone's had. There's all sorts of reasons that if you choose to drink, just try and remember what Mark has said to you in this podcast today, that there is no miracle. Every Christmas time I'm asked to do a press feature on foods that help relieve a hangover and things like that. It comes out every year and I always end up saying, well, no, you can't cure a hangover. There's no miracle, basically. It just don't do it in the first place is the boring, horrible answer. But we all drink and enjoy a bit every now and again. Mark, if you could leave our listeners with a take-home food for thought today, you've been so wonderful. What would that be?
It really is just if you need some support, just really do sort of reach out and get something. You'll talk to someone like me, and hopefully I've come across as someone who is keen to support you. And
of course.
And it's that early intervention. And if you're really struggling, get help as well. We're here to help. Lots of people are aware of the complexities that life throws at people. So get that support in early if you can do. So that'd be my take-home message.
Oh, Mark, thank you. Where can our listeners go to find out more about you, or what services would you recommend? Any take-homes quickly?
Yeah, so we're part. I work for a charity called Humankind, and we have a service called Drink Coach, which offers a website, an app. But that was something you can do that audit screening tool on it. And also then you can get appointments that way as well. So we've got some areas where the appointments are free and then some areas where the appointments are paid for. That's where you go for. If you want to go away from Drink Coach, then there's things like Alcohol Change UK that we've got a really good list of sites as well. But most of the information is on that Drink Coach website with some tips to cut down, etc. And it's been all of that website has actually been co-produced, as we call it. So it comes from our service users. The app has been going now for 6 or 7 years, and we get feedback from it, and we make those changes on that app. So it's all done via service users and recommendations that way. Because that's what it should all be about: the person using the service, not about us professionals.
Mark, I don't even know what to say. I feel like I should do another episode actually with you on something like this, because there's too much to cover actually, and there's a lot more I know we could have discussed, but it was so informative and I can't thank you enough for your invaluable time today.
Really good talking to you.
Brilliant. Thanks for coming on Food for Thought.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, you'll absolutely love what's coming next week, so make sure that you click subscribe to be the first to hear it. If you have time to, we'd really appreciate it if you want to leave a review so that we can reach those higher highs in the charts and hopefully help more people. That is our mission here with this podcast. For more information about my Retrition Clinic, the books, healthy recipes and so much more, please visit Retrition.com and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook and YouTube.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.